Good morning, Connecticut. And to our friends across the Sound, it's Director of Public Affairs, John Vokette. Thanks for tuning in to Connoisseur Media's award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you the latest information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. We're going to open up today with the next segment in our new series called Open Arms, Open Hearts, Connecticut's Role in the Afghan Refugee Crisis. We're going to chat with the CEO of the Connecticut Institute for Refugees and Immigrants, SIRI, about an important new partnership with the Bridgeport Rescue Mission and how the agency is working hard, assisting refugees, immigrants, and survivors of human trafficking and torture, resolving legal, economic, linguistic, and social barriers, and how you can get involved to help. Then we're going to circle back with the American Lung Association of Connecticut to discuss the fourth annual State of Lung Cancer Report that was released this week, highlighting how the toll of lung cancer varies by state and examining key indicators here in Connecticut, including new case survival, early diagnosis, surgical treatments, lack of treatment, and screening rates, as well as how the lung cancer burden among racial and ethnic minority groups at the national and state levels is taking its toll. Then we're going to close with the Executive Director of GVI, Bridgeport's Green Village Initiative. Just because there's frost on the pumpkin and harvest season at GVI's many community gardens is past, doesn't mean this agricultural and human service nonprofit is hibernating for the winter. Stay tuned to hear how GVI is continuing its good work toward feeding more hungry families with fresh, healthy, locally grown food. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Vokette, right after this reminder. You know, Griffin Hospital and the Health Initiatives for Men, HIM, are going to host free prostate cancer screenings from 4 to 6 p.m. on Tuesday, November 30th at the Center for Cancer Care at Griffin Hospital on Seymour Avenue in Derby. Prostate cancer screenings are especially recommended for men at 50 years old, men at higher risk, including African American men, and those who have a first degree relative diagnosed with prostate cancer before age 65 should be screened at age 45. And you guys at a very high risk should receive testing at age 40. These screenings will take about 10 to 15 minutes, and space for those free screenings is limited, so early registration is important. So to get registered, call 203-732-1280 or just visit griffinhealth.org. Well, since we closed last week's show with our friend Chris George at IRIS, it's only appropriate that we open this week with our friends at the Connecticut Institute for Refugees and Immigrants, SIRI. And I'm so pleased to be able to do that as we take on our next segment in this series. We're calling Open Arms, Open Hearts, Connecticut's Role in the Afghan Refugee Crisis. And you, each and every one of you with ears on the podcast or on the radio, have a role to play here in Connecticut. We've got 800 to 1,000 Afghan refugees coming into the state as we speak. Several hundred here already, many more to come. Winter's coming, and we need to provide a warm home and welcome these folks and families who have been through so much. So, so pleased to be here with Susan Schnitzer of SIRI. And Susan, how is it going these days? Are you back up to your kind of 7-day, 10-hour-a-day routine?
We are, John, and thank you for having us. We're really thrilled to be here. Yes, we are back up fully running. We actually never closed during COVID, so we have been running at full capacity nonstop. And I do have to say, you know, to utilize your words, the state really has been welcoming with open arms and open hearts for decades for immigrants and refugees coming to Connecticut and making new homes here. And so it's no surprise to us, but incredibly heartwarming that folks, there's a huge outpouring of support for our new neighbors that have fled Afghanistan, coming to resettle in the country.
Well, your organization provides top-notch legal, social, and educational programming for refugees, immigrants, and also for survivors of human trafficking and torture. And that's not really something we touched upon in our interview last week, but it really is kind of important to educate people and to talk a little bit more about how victims of human trafficking and torture, how that so incredibly compounds the challenges of relocation for some of the refugees. Are you seeing any of our Afghan new neighbors who are coming in who have been victimized in that way?
So we don't, not currently, but typically what we will do with specifically human trafficking is if we do assess for risk factors. What's different with the refugee resettlement and the resettlement of the Afghan folks coming is in more traditional times, if there is such a thing, we usually get about 2 to 3 weeks notice when a family will be arriving. Mm-hmm. And with that notice, we know the names of everyone in the family members. We get a lot of background information. And most of the folks are coming from refugee camps, mm-hmm. Where they've spent, 10 to 20 years, a lot of them. A lot of the children we resettle who are under the age of 10 were born in these camps. So while that is a horrendously long time to wait after having fled a horrendous situation, there's time to kind of sit and settle and plan next steps. Mm. The folks coming from Afghanistan have quite literally fled their homes with a bag, if they have the bag, jumped on a plane, and a lot of them did not know where they would be landing. So, they're coming here, they're hosted at our military bases. But the time from, leaving your living room to landing in a new living room here in Connecticut could be as quick as a month. So we are really mindful of the fact that folks need a chance to really sit with themselves, with their families, with other community members, and get their bearings. Our job upon arrival is to make sure folks are comfortable, whether it is in an apartment that we have beautifully furnished by a host of faith-based groups that assist us, or at something very new and unique, I think across the country, definitely here in the state and definitely for Siri, is a partnership that we have with Bridgeport Rescue Mission. Mm-hmm. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Oh, no, the good friends of ours here at For the People. We just did a segment on them within the past couple of months, and they've been on the program so many times, and I have had personal opportunity to work with that group over the past 25 years, and you have acquired a fantastic partner there. Let's talk a little bit about Bridgeport Rescue Mission and this new collaboration with the Afghan refugees.
Yes, for sure. So both Bridgeport Rescue Mission and Siri have been in the Bridgeport area for over 100 years, and this is our strongest collaboration. At least I have not been here for 100 years, but that I know of. Mm-hmm. So how this came about is Kim Fawcett, who's one of their directors over there, saw an article about Siri and resettling the Afghan evacuees, and they had space. They have a gorgeous building, brand new building, and a floor that is going to be dedicated as a women and children's program. They were not ready to open that program yet. Saw the need and reached out to us. And kind of long story short, we had a number of meetings. I know you've had Kim on your show, so you know how fabulous she is, and her team, and our teams are they're working together like they always have, right? Like they didn't just meet each other, that we've been doing this for decades. So what Bridgeport Rescue Mission has offered to our new neighbors is a space that is safe, that is beautiful, that is incredibly culturally appropriate for the folks coming, where they can spend some time, a week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, before we find that permanent housing. Mm. And we are able to put five families in family suites. They are able to separate the shower facilities, which is very important for the folks coming in, between the men and the women. They have a beautiful community area where the clients are now cooking together, sharing meals together, and the clients themselves welcoming new clients as they come into the facility at Bridgeport Rescue Mission. Mm.
Well, I think it's also important, Susan, to kind of delineate in my assessment. There's two major representations in the groups of Afghan refugees that are coming in. There are the folks who fear or do not want any part of Taliban rule. And then there are those who are actually under threat, in many cases, of death by the Taliban because they supported U.S. efforts. They translated or were fixers or assistants to the U.S. military. And so what is the proportion of people that you're seeing who are either expected or are already here, who are simply fleeing the oppressive regime of the Taliban versus those who had no other choice to go or face death?
So that is a number we don't even have on a national level right now. I can tell you with the clients that we have received, the majority of them are either under direct threat or they have family members who have been involved with the United States military and the efforts you described, who it could be a cousin, it could be a fourth cousin, who are under direct threat. I would say that's a majority of folks that we're seeing. And I would argue that those who are not related to somebody who has worked, worked in collaboration with the U.S., the risk is just as great for them. Mm-hmm. What we're hearing is people are going door to door, and it's not just those who have been involved with the American military that are at immediate risk for torture, death. Mm-hmm. So anyone coming, anyone who has fled, in my belief and what we've seen, has fled for literally fled for their lives.
Okay. So in the last couple minutes that we have with you, Susan, as we did with our partners here with IRIS, please speak to our listeners and let them know how they could help a little, how they could help a lot. I know that a lot of people, they know coming into the wintertime, it's going to be tough. Coming into the holiday season, it's going to be tough. What can our listeners do for Siri and for your new Afghan neighbors?
Sure, wonderful. So first, I want to thank people because, as I've said before, and a lot of us have said, our folks, our neighbors in Connecticut, have been incredibly, incredibly welcoming. Our largest challenge right now is finding affordable apartments for Siri. That's specifically Bridgeport and surrounding areas, and even up in New Haven. Very similar to IRIS in New Haven. A lot of folks do have family members and friends that are living in that community. So any leads, any connection for apartments. The second thing is, donate to our agency. Any amount is very helpful. And keep an eye out for where we are going to need more volunteers for, maybe something that's a little more person to person. Right now, we are trying to get folks in apartments, get those apartments set up. We have a lot of community groups doing drives. So drives collecting glasses for 30, 30, 40, 50 families, cutlery, those types of things. And people can go to our website, www.cirict.org. And there's everything we need and we're looking for are on those websites. And the last thing I will say is just, keep building your communities, keep welcoming new people into communities, regardless of where they're from.
Very good. And of course, a shout out to all of the faith-based networks who are already working hand in hand and again, almost 24/7 with SERI and our other intake agencies here in Connecticut, because they are leading the charge. And chances are, if you're part of a faith-based community, they leadership is already engaged with SERI or other agencies over this effort. So enough can't be said for our faith-based communities and partners here, as well as our friends at Bridgeport Rescue Mission, who are jumping in to assist with the incoming and existing Afghan refugees. We really appreciate you, Susan. Susan Schnitzer is the CEO of SERI, the Connecticut Institute for Refugees and Immigrants, serving our community since 1918. So you know that they do a great job, and we really thank you for your time this morning, Susan. And we look forward to working with you as this situation continues to develop. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much, John, and thank you to all your listeners as well.
So here we are in mid-November as we're recording this with our friend Ruth Canovi from the American Lung Association of Connecticut. And of course, November is Lung Cancer Awareness Month. And around this time every year, we hear from Ruth and her associates about, at least over the past few years, about the American Lung Association's annual State of Lung Cancer Report. This year's the fourth annual report, and it was released just a couple of days ago, and it highlights how the toll of lung cancer varies by state and examines key indicators throughout the U.S., including new cases, survival, early diagnosis, surgical treatment, lack of treatment, and screening rates. This is the second year that the State of Lung Cancer Report explores the lung cancer burden among racial and ethnic minority groups at the national and state levels as well. So we've got lots to talk about in this midpoint segment. Ruth, just a quick reminder, we will be taking a quick break in the middle of the conversation. But otherwise, how did the rollout go for you guys this year?
Yeah, great. Well, thank you so much. You're always so good to cover lung health issues, and so I appreciate the opportunity to speak with you. I'm really pleased that we've got this report. It's, as you mentioned, our fourth annual one, and it's an important one and an opportunity to talk about lung cancer. I think a lot of people are surprised to hear that lung cancer is responsible for the most cancer deaths, both in our state and country. And we've got a lot of data points, as you mentioned, and we can talk about a lot of these things. But when I kind of look at all of the data, I feel like it's kind of a mix, right? Like we have really made a lot of progress in the last two decades or so in terms of lung cancer survival rates, catching it earlier, and treatments for sure are all really important progress. But when we look at, you know, our lung cancer five-year survival rate nationally is 23.7%. That was an increase of 14.5%. However, that's still only 23.7% of people who are diagnosed with lung cancer are around 5 years later. So that's really stark. And even Connecticut, when we look at our numbers, we are ranked first for survival rate. And that's 28.8% of people. So while we're better than the national average, and certainly better than we were two decades ago, it's just a reminder of how important it is to catch these cases earlier, do all that we can to prevent them, and use the treatments that we have seen that really are improving people's outcomes as well.
Yeah, and for people like you on the inside, it's kind of a muted celebration when it comes to Connecticut's ranking as number one, because we have these pockets of disparities in terms of racial equity across the board. I understand that while we are celebrating this 28+% survival rate after 5 years, that does not include everyone in the state.
No, absolutely. And even nationally, when we look at those big numbers, right, like so we said there was an increase of 23.7%. For communities of color, it's 28%. And if you look specifically at Black Americans, it's 18% for a five-year survival rate. And that's kind of consistent throughout lots of the research and the many indicators that we look at. And so this is kind of, I'm very pleased that this is a focus of this report, that we're tracking it. Like even in Connecticut this past year, Senate Bill 1 passed, and that was declaring racism as a public health crisis. And one of those big points of that was the importance of collecting and analyzing good data so that then we can create public health interventions that make sense and really focus on targeting the inequities that exist. So again, I feel like this is a really important step to collect the data of how lung cancer isn't impacting everyone.
Some of these inequities also kind of overlay similar inequities that we're hearing in terms of folks surviving or minimizing the impact of COVID-19. Is there any idea or could you talk at all about the impact that COVID-19, given the fact that it's primarily a respiratory, or its affectation is mostly a respiratory situation. How did folks with lung cancer who may have contracted COVID-19, any data there?
That's a good question. And unfortunately, I think that's the case when the data takes a little bit of time to catch up with where we're at and to get that.
So it's a conversation for 2022, right, I guess, right?
For sure. Yeah. But I think one data point that we did see was that in 2020, it was the first time that national screening rates didn't increase from the year before, likely because people in 2020 weren't accessing just that general healthcare that people normally do, right, because of the lockdowns and people's staying at home and not necessarily accessing care. And so that is an important data point that we're kind of paying attention to and looking at even now in the work that we're doing and trying to encourage people to get screening, because that is one thing that we know likely impacted people.
We'll talk a little bit more about that, because we did hit the top five in early diagnosis.
Yeah, we did. And so, again, 29.1% of cases were caught early. And one stark thing that really jumps out at me was, even if you look nationally, right, like 24% of cases were diagnosed at an early stage. In Connecticut, we fared better with 29.1%. When cases are caught early, the five-year survival rate is much higher, at like 60% or so. But when, unfortunately, about 46% of cases are not caught until a late stage, and at that point, survival rate is only 6%. So it just really underlies, you know, the importance of trying to get people, especially who are at high risk, to get screened with a low-dose CT screening that is available. And we really need to do that, because in Connecticut, for our screening rates, we're 17th. In the nation, where 7.6% of people who are eligible are getting screened for lung cancer. And so that, I think, is an area that people all over the country are really trying to focus on and ensure that people who are eligible for screening can get screened. And if people are curious, I mean, always encourage people to talk to their healthcare providers. The Lung Association does have a website called savedbythescan.org, where people can go in and just, you know, take a look at what are the requirements and eligibility that people, eligibility criteria for people who can get screened. But then obviously talk to healthcare providers as well.
And for those, younger people who sadly are being affected and more by a number of different cancers, lung cancer among them, a lot of these young people may be in that situation where, you know, they've got the real high deductible, high premium health plans, and generally they're still, you know, speaking broadly, they're feeling pretty bulletproof, but there's been significant increases, or at least no leveling off or decrease in like tobacco consumption and vaping and things that that may exacerbate or hasten a lung cancer diagnosis. So can we talk just a little bit about what people should be looking for in themselves in terms of behaviors that might trigger them to need to consider one of these scans?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so you brought up a lot of really good, important points. And so, right, like the young people, we have a lot of individuals and volunteers who engage with us who have really awful stories, you know, about really young people contracting this. And right, there's so many things that impact people's health. And we know with this, right, like if people are using tobacco, please quit. If you need help, there's a lot of resources available for you. People are surprised about the impact of radon on lung cancer throughout our country. Mm-hmm. But lung cancer, or radon, is the second kind of a risk factor or the second leading cause of lung cancer. Yeah. In our state and country. So we encourage people to test their homes, especially in the wintertime. January is actually National Radon Action Month, because that tends to be a time when our windows aren't open as much, and there's really opportunity for that. So we encourage people, and also pay attention to air pollution. Particulate matter is a carcinogen. And so we're trying to do all that we can do on the policy level to reduce that exposure, but also on days when things are looking bad for air quality, try to stay indoors. There's a lot that we can do on the kind of prevention, personal side of things. But we also, you know, at the Lung Association say, you know, anyone with lungs can get lung cancer, and no one deserves it. And so while we want to encourage these behaviors and just paying attention to our bodies when we feel like we've got this cough that doesn't seem to go away, and you know, the pneumonia diagnosis doesn't seem right, you know, all of those things, just encourage people to really be advocates for themselves too.
Good. Ruth Canovey's with us. She's from the American Lung Association of Connecticut. We talk to Ruth and her counterparts annually or more so about all the great work that they're doing to try to educate people and prevent lung cancer and other lung ailments. Their 2021 State of Lung Cancer Report is out. It's got some good news for Connecticut, mixed news for certain population groups. We're going to come back and talk just a little bit more. We got about 6 or 7 more minutes with Ruth. We'll come back and talk more after the break. Ruth and everyone, stick with us. We'll be right back. Hey, do you volunteer for or receive services from any of the hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots organizations in our region? Or maybe you're just looking for ways to help. If your favorite nonprofit is hosting a fundraiser or community building activity, or you'd like to find a nonprofit to support in your neighborhood, just go to our radio station website, hit the events tab, and find one, or discover some of the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm John Voquette, your public affairs director here at Connoisseur Media, and we'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Are you looking for that perfect holiday gift? Well, Special Olympics Connecticut is offering an array of items and experiences to seasonal shoppers during its Choose to Include holiday auction, with proceeds benefiting athletes of all abilities the organization serves. The Choose to Include auction is going live at SOCT.org on Friday, November 26th at 6 a.m., and it's going to continue through Friday, December 10th at 10 p.m. In addition to bidding on items, those that want to support this fundraiser can make a donation online or by texting CHOOSE, the number 2, the word INCLUDE, to 76278. And to find out more, you can visit SOCT.org or follow Special Olympics Connecticut on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram to view featured auction items and buy now, as well as Black Friday deals. So get involved. SOCT.org. Thanks for being with us here. Ruth Canovi is on the line. She's with the American Lung Association of Connecticut. Their 2021 State of Lung Cancer, this fourth annual report was released earlier this week, and it highlights how the toll of lung cancer varies by state and examines key indicators throughout the U.S. And we're talking more pointedly about things that are happening here in Connecticut. So, Ruth, we did fairly well also in the top five in terms of surgical treatment rate. Let's kind of key in on that a little bit, because advancements in surgery, particularly robotic surgery, I'm sure are making significant inroads. What's the story on surgical rates?
Right. And so, I mean, that's also kind of an indicator how closely those surgical treatment and early diagnosis are related, and generally outcomes for when lung cancer is treated with surgery as like that first stage and doesn't necessarily need radiation or chemo. Those cases are really, or outcomes are much better. So that it's very closely related to when things are early diagnosed, but we also know that when lung cancer can be treated with surgery, it hasn't spread, and that generally means that outcomes are much better.
Can you talk at all about any kind of advancements that are getting more traction since we talked to you last year, whether it be surgical or otherwise, that are starting to make a difference here in Connecticut?
Yeah, I mean, I just think we started really focusing on lung cancer, and you know, we had done a lot of prevention work for so many years, but really focusing, we came up with our Lung Force campaign that really is aiming at tracking this data. We have a lot of resources for people who've been diagnosed, and so when we look at just the progress that has been made in these, you know, 6 or 7 or so years, when we look at just the number of treatments that have been approved by FDA in that time, is really striking. There's been some serious changes in one. There's been a lot more investments made in lung cancer research. We've talked about this a little bit, but there's been a lot of stigma associated with lung cancer for a long time, and there wasn't a lot of funds going into researching how to make improvements. And so we often go down to DC and advocate for increases in funding for overall cancer research with the NIH, but we've seen huge, huge strides in treatments that are available, like immunotherapy. We've got a number of people, like I said, our Lung Force heroes, who talk about kind of where they're at. And I've, you know, well, even personally, I have an uncle who passed away from lung cancer, and that was 2 decades ago, and it was so fast. And it really is very heartening to talk to a father and daughter team that have been doing some advocacy with us, who the father had lung cancer, and he's in great shape right now. He was able to be there for his daughter's or his grandson's birth. And so there's just a lot of progress being made. So like we said, it's so important to get early diagnosis, but there really are improved treatments available for people even when it's caught a little bit later. So it's heartening, and we're moving in the right direction. And so that does feel like we're moving in the right step.
Yeah. Well, one of the other areas we probably should talk about is the fact that we're, a little ways down the list in terms of lack of treatment. But looking across the nation, I mean, we're still looking at 2 out of 10 people, a little bit more than 2 out of 10 people who are not seeking any treatment at all. Does this come with that in certain mindsets, the stigma that lung cancer is still a death sentence no matter what? So why shouldn't I just, live my life and not get bogged down in the intricacies and burdens of various types of treatment?
Yes. I mean, I think there are many reasons why patients might not receive treatment after diagnosis. And some of them, we're looking at, right, you said the stigma associated with lung cancer, fatalism after diagnosis. Sometimes it's the cost of treatment, but we just want to acknowledge no one should go untreated because of, you know, a lack of provider or patient knowledge. So we really are trying to raise awareness, but that's a point that's surprising and feels like we definitely need to dig into that a little bit more and see how we can help with that. Because like we said, lung cancer diagnosis is not the death sentence that people perceived it to be 20 years ago.
Very good. Well, I wanted to just in the last minute or so that we have let folks know if there's anything else that is coming up, any advocacy that you might want to put our listeners to work supporting in terms of the upcoming state legislative session coming up in a few more weeks or even at the national level.
Yeah, there's been a lot going on the national level. I've been following lots of the things happening, and we were pleased. You know, I talked about air pollution, but the investments that are being made in electric school buses can really have an impact on the quality of the air that we're breathing. So we were pleased to see that in the infrastructure package that went. And are following closely some of the things around healthcare access that are in potentially in what could be Build Back Better. So there's a lot going on. And if people are curious, please engage with us at, you know, www.lung.org. I'm Ruth Canovi. So if people want to reach out to me, my contact information is there if you have questions about how to engage. And then on the state level, you know, tobacco is always an area that we'll be following. We really want to see an investment in tobacco programs that prevent young people from getting hooked and helping people quit who want to. And we know a lot of people who use tobacco want to quit. And that's going to be a big priority of ours in the coming session. But in general, access to healthcare, you know, quality, affordable healthcare, and improving the quality of the air that we all breathe. And so I really appreciate you taking the time and talking to us and, you know, covering this really important topic.
Well, we appreciate you. Ruth Canovi is with the American Lung Association of Connecticut. For current and former smokers, don't forget there's life-saving resources available. Find out if you're eligible for the lung cancer screening that we talked about earlier at savedbythescan.org and talk to your doctor about getting screened or learn more and review the State of Lung Cancer, the fourth annual edition at lung.org/SOLC. Thanks, Ruth. So we're pleased to be joined by someone we met a couple of years ago and we've had on the program a couple of times. Ellie Angram is with us. She's executive director of GVI, the Green Village Initiative. If you haven't heard of it, you ought to. They are a nonprofit in Bridgeport whose mission is to grow food, knowledge, leadership, and community through urban gardening and farming to create a more just food system in Bridgeport and are now serving as sort of food system diplomats to anyone who might want to come and learn from them. They've got workshops and activities, four core programs to help both the community and the folks in it. So, Ellie, thanks for joining us on the program today. Great to have you back.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, John. Happy fall.
Happy fall. And with that, just a weekend or so ago, as we were taping this, the kind of conclusion of one season in GVI with your big Harvest Fest. I was really hoping that I could be there, but a last-minute glitch caused my absence. But that doesn't mean we can't talk about it. Let's do a quick look back on your Harvest Fest and sort of the traditional end of the growing year at your Reservoir Community Farm.
Yeah, and Harvest Fests are, you know, traditional across the globe. It's so special that we get to have this opportunity to create a festival to welcome the harvest season and welcome our community to take part in that. I love that we're able to host it on Reservoir Community Farm. And this year was, you know, it's one to beat. We had about 350 attendees come out, which is our largest yet. And it was such a meaningful and collaborative day thanks in great part to the partnership we've been building with the Pawgasset tribe. Clan Mother Sharan Wapatukwai Piper came out and spoke at Harvest Fest as our keynote speaker. And we had just a cadre of incredible sponsors and chefs and vendors who made the event really one to remember. And a special moment for me, I have to say, was just I was standing back watching as some elders from our neighborhood were sitting there with their little grandchildren listening to live jazz. And, you know, some younger kids were kind of chasing around a butterfly through what was left of our okra. And, you know, these are moments that are going to stay with me and our community for a long time and tie us back to our land, which I think is really important and valuable in a Harvest Fest to remember it's more than just a party. It's really a connection to seasons and time together.
Yeah, nothing like the butterflies and the okra to remind you of how much a part of a bigger thing that GVI is. And I say that just half jokingly, because since you guys have come and established yourselves in Bridgeport, thanks to our friends at Farm Aid a few years ago, you've kind of gained some national or even global attention, and more recently, as we talked about on the program, the very survival of Reservoir Community Farm is in the news. So last time you were on the program, Ellie, we talked a little bit about the challenges that you were having, issues with the possibility of the city wanting to install a public library on that property. Give us a catch up on what's been happening in terms of the actual farm property.
Yeah, absolutely. We've continued to have great conversations and open dialogue with the library's board of directors here in Bridgeport, which has been incredibly helpful. They've been great partners and really been open and honest that, you know, this wasn't a design necessarily of theirs to come onto that land, but they want to work together. And so at this exact juncture in time, we are in a little bit of a holding pattern, currently waiting for our Office of Planning and Economic Development, as well as the City of Bridgeport attorney to draft a new lease. And once that lease is drafted, the way, and you know, this is why farming is political, you got to know the process. Once that lease is drafted, it's going to need to pass through City Council because we are on City of Bridgeport owned land. So an important part of this will be really gathering our community and keeping everyone informed. That's why signing up for our newsletter and just staying in touch with us when we're going to have some online community forums about the process. You know, that's where we really want people to stay in touch so they can reach out to their council person and say, hey, I'd really like you to vote for this. And we're so grateful to everyone that made this into an issue, yourself included, John, and also the several hundred people who signed our petition to make this into a top priority, as well as the dozens and dozens of people who wrote letters and emails of support. We're going to be really drawing on our community to help us get past this finish line and have a fresh lease in February so that our farming season and farming in perpetuity for the next couple of years can stay in that lane. And then we can share the land with the library when that time comes.
Excellent. A few other things to talk about that are of key importance and a critical reason why GVI, the Green Village Initiative, needs its home there in Bridgeport is their youth leadership programs. When you think of all of the challenges that youths have had throughout the state of Connecticut and beyond with the COVID-19 pandemic, the separation, the break in the routines, and for some, a one-year-plus break in the system and a process of the way they get educated. Things like youth leadership programs, sadly, have maybe not been prioritized as much while kids are just trying to get educated and communities are trying to make that happen. But your youth leadership program is kind of a shining light there, Ellie. Let's talk more about that.
Yeah, I think when we think about nonprofit services, especially those serving youth in Bridgeport and in most major urban cities, we are, like you said, we're trying to fill a gap. And what we hear overwhelmingly year after year when folks are asked, okay, if we wanted to change the city budget, how would we change it? overwhelmingly, our community says education and youth resources. And so while I'm so grateful that we can boast that we have a really robust youth leadership program where we grow teens into leaders and help them kind of access some of their latent skills and grow themselves and see themselves as individuals who can change the world, I do hope that over time we can build more programming that does this. So some of the ways that GVI is creatively doing that is networking. And we're networking not only with other nonprofits that are really, you know, in the city doing the work, like PT Partners and 100 Black Professional Women. But we're also thinking critically about how do we get that next generation to bridge the gap and be interested in going outdoors and getting involved with their environment. And that's really where some of our school garden programming comes in. And it's been incredibly heartwarming to see our field trips begin again. We host free field trips for public school students from Bridgeport Public Schools. And these experiential field trips are, like I said, heartwarming, but also very hand-dirtying. And it gets our kids a little bit more information about nutrition and where food comes from, while also building out their sense of self and that they really can have an interaction with the environment around them, growing food and inquiring as to why things look the way they are and how they can be different. That's really a building block for a more just food system, is making sure our youth are asking questions and seeing themselves as solutions.
Ellie Ingram's with us. She's executive director of the Green Village Initiative, GVI. All you need to know is gogvi.org to get hooked up and learn all about the stuff that's going on at GVI, including their Reservoir Community Farm. Ellie, it's probably quite cliched to say or to point out all of the things that have grown, not just at Reservoir Community Farm, but from the Reservoir Community Farm, including a lot of other initiatives around the city of Bridgeport, like school gardens. So I guess my question is, you know, sort of now as we've got frost on the pumpkin and we're moving into the winter season shortly, how many of your school gardens have been able to sort of, you know, take some of their GVI initiative back inside to sustain it through the winter and get ready for next spring?
Yeah, well, that is always the question that folks ask is, what do farmers do all winter? And any farmer or gardener you know will tell you. Yeah, we plan and we get ready to do it all again. And so at GVI, we're a busy hive of bees doing just that. And that includes hosting professional development days for teachers that we've classically they're done virtually. You can find them on our YouTube page or on our website. So that's not just for teachers to professionally develop as garden educators, but really parents or homeschooling folks can use these too. And we've got so many great resources in what we call our tool shed on our website so that kids can be learning about food and using these resources year-round in all the Common Core areas to really create that connection, again, back to food, back to land, and so that they can really see themselves, again, as a solution to these questions that cause us to have hunger and inequality in our city. And also through the winter, you know, not just in terms of education for young children or for educators, traditional educators, but also for those of us who are at home and looking for ways to build our skills or build our knowledge banks. GVI over the winter is going to be hosting winter virtual workshop series on food justice, listening sessions to vision for the future of food and gardening in Bridgeport. We're going to have farmer talks with local Bridgeport and other urban farmers from around Connecticut. And we're going to have a variety of different skill shares online. We're really looking forward to building out this calendar and having great ways for folks to kind of virtually you know, touch base with us, learn alongside us, so that when we come together outside in the spring, we've already been in connection. We're still here. We're we're ready to keep teaching and keep learning from our community all winter long.
Oh, that sounds great. Well, one of the other things we wanted to talk about was, you know, 2 years ago when we were able to come to Harvest Fest and talk to your predecessor, it was so gratifying at that time to hear how GVI was populating neighborhoods all over Bridgeport with community gardens, and the jewel and the crown of that system now under your leadership is the Urban Roots Community Garden. Tell us a little bit about that and how the folks who are involved in it and sustaining it going to be getting through the winter months and hopefully to a much more robust spring 2022.
Oh, I'm sorry, John, you're breaking up. Can you hear me?
Yep, sorry about that. About the Urban Roots Community Garden, what's right, in store right. for those volunteers?
Sure. Yeah, so Urban Roots was the original name of the community gardens that we merged into GVI, and the 12 existing community gardens are located all across Bridgeport. And what we really enjoy is that over the summer, our community gardens are vibrant. They're filled with food from all over the world, and our gardeners are busy. These are folks who are our neighbors and our friends all over the city. They're working jobs, they're gardening in their free time. So in the winter, that's really our time to gather folks together and again do free workshops and trainings. We love to do trainings such as conflict management. So being able to kind of build social emotional intelligence among our network of gardeners and our garden captains so that they can kind of communicate about things that might come up during the season. And honestly, I think we could all use as individuals coming out of a pandemic when it was very independent and we're now back in community. And that's so important because when communication is really solid among our community gardens and between us and the city, we're able to get resources into these community gardens, including free water. GVI pays for soil and seeds and compost. And our gardeners, again, like I mentioned before, we're growing food from all over the world. So yesterday I was connecting with a woman named Eva, who's in our Reservoir Community Garden. She's growing papalo, which is great for her because she's lactose intolerant. But she was also harvesting all of her marigolds before the frost to go on her ofrenda for Dia de los Muertos for her father. And then earlier this season, I was able to see 3-foot-long beans being grown in another garden while we were weeding. I was able to eat fresh figs off of our community garden in the Little Arctic next to the captain there, I Messiah, and learn about all different types of Thai peppers and Thai cucumbers from a really wonderful woman named Sue on Hallett. So, like, I think the beauty and magic of our community garden network is that the busyness of the summer allows for kind of a quieter personal reflection in the winter, so we can come back as better community members in the summer to continue to work together again and really fight hunger through, you know, accessing land and resources together because we're stronger in community.
And toward that end, keeping that community and GVI in synergy and keeping GVI at the top of mind of community members in Bridgeport coming up on December 7th. You've got a little bit of a holiday activity going on. We've got about a minute left. Ellie, just give us the lowdown on that.
Oh, sure. I'm happy to invite everyone listening to our in-person tree lighting event on December 7th from 4 to 5. Please check out the GVI Instagram and our website, gogvi.org, for more information. We'll have ways to get warm, plenty of hand and foot warmers available, maybe a safe little fire pit, as well as treats for everyone. Some local choirs will be singing. We'll be lighting our tree after reading some poetry. And we'll also have kids crafts and activities for little fingers to stay busy.
Nice. Ellie Ingram is the executive director of GVI, the Green Village Initiative. GoGVI.org is their website, and their farms and gardens nurture a grassroots movement of urban growers of all ages throughout the city of Bridgeport. They manage that network of community gardens, School Gardens and the Reservoir Community Farm, as well as a youth leadership program for the benefit of the community, the region, and our state of Connecticut. Ellie, thank you so much for your time this morning, and we can't wait to hopefully see you at the tree lighting and hear more as we move into spring 2022 and hopefully finally make a visit down to Reservoir Community Farms to see for ourselves and hear for ourselves what's going on. Thank you so much.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program for the people. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host. If you have a suggestion for an issue, a guest, or a PSA relevant to the audience and community served by our radio station, you must make a request for consideration in writing to me via email at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file detailing the many critical community and state issues addressed on For the People can be reviewed upon request during normal business hours at 440 Wheeler's Farms Road in Milford or on our station website. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Viette. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. Join us again this time next week for more conversation and information on the award-winning For the People. And don't forget, you can listen to this and other For the People podcasts anytime on iTunes or under the podcast tab on our station's website. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.